Call the meeting to order of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. We do have a quorum. First order of business will be to approve the minutes from yesterday, I guess, January 13th. Do I have a motion? Representative Rosenthal? All right. All those in favor of the minutes? Say aye.
Aye.
Good. A little weak, but still good. Minutes approved. We have with us today the Office of Higher Education and Commissioner Pogamiller. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you all the equipment's on? And
I think we are.
Ready to roll?
I think we are.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and I look forward to your presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. It's an honor to be here, to have the opportunity to be with you, and I know there's quite a few new members to the committee, and so I've been asked to provide kind of an overview both of our office, but also generally about post-secondary education. For those of you who have been around, Tricia Grimes, who was with us for 28 years, with this office for 28 years, has retired. And so we've got two of our researchers who are going to fill in for her this legislative session. And I just want to introduce them. One will focus mostly on the House, and that's Nikki Oliver, who, if she hasn't been around to see you, will be. And then mostly in the Senate, although they're interchangeable for your purposes, is Maren Henderson. And they have other responsibilities, but they obviously during the session on our staff, they will spend most of their time with you. So. They and the office in general wants to be a resource for you for information you need. And it should be, not all information has to go through the commissioner, so you should, as individual members, understand that if you need information and you just don't want to share it, their professional staff who can share it with you as best they can without running to my office and telling me that you're asking that question. And I just wanted you to be aware of that. That's kind of the history of the office. It's nonpartisan. Other than the commissioner and the deputy, it's pretty much professional staff that have been there for many years or are hired professionally, not politically.
Commissioner, just a basic question. When you mentioned your office, they might be interested to know where it is.
We're off campus. It's the Office of Higher Ed, and it is over by the fairgrounds on Energy Park Drive, just east of Snelling. And it's in a building. It's called the ETC building. And there's a Minsky campus there, basically, along with a couple private businesses. But we're on a little floor, and then so there's all kinds of Minsky students there during the day and the night. So it's a pretty active building. It's right by the fairgrounds, off campus, away from here, which has some advantages and some disadvantages. So.
Thank you.
We need to pause to turn on, I'm told we need to pause to turn on the TV.
Okay.
Okay. And I think you all have this in your packet. And feel free to ask questions along the way. If I can't answer them, I'll ask a resource person or we'll get back to you. So first, the Office of Higher Ed. Relatively small, about 85 people. And relatively small relative to other state agencies. And about 20 of them work actually in the K-12 system and do college preparedness with students. And we administer state financial aid programs, state grant program, which is need-based grants, self-loan program, which is a low-interest subsidized loan program, similar to what the feds do. And then we have smaller, those are the two big pieces. The others are child care grants, work study grants, GI Bill, and a Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program. We register or license all post-secondary institutions other than the University of Minnesota and Minsky. So St. Thomas registers with us. They license with us, and there's some nuances to that, but they either register or license if you're not the university or Minsky. We negotiate and administer tuition reciprocity agreements, and North Dakota and Wisconsin are the two biggest reciprocity players, but we also have South Dakota, Manitoba, and a college in northwestern Iowa. We administer some federal programs. The biggest one is this Get Ready program, which is these 20 staff people that are in elementary and or middle and high schools working with students, preparing them for college. We also have another example is an improving teacher quality program where feds have sent, I think it's $800 million, and we administer the grants for that. Then finally, one of our biggest functions is to collect and report post-secondary data. And so we're a repository where all these post-secondary institutions send their data to us, and we put it into something called Minnesota Measures, which is online, or we'll give you a hard copy of that in a few days, which has all the data about what's going on in post-secondary education in Minnesota. And there's something called SLEDS, Statewide Longitudinal Educational Data System, that began being developed about 5 years ago with federal seed money in every state in the country. And we're the lead agency on that in Minnesota. And it is an attempt, it's a tool to connect K-12 data, post-secondary data, and workforce data in a manner that policymakers can see what's going on, what's working, what's not working. And I think the intent is to have us come back and talk a lot about SLEDS later on.
Right. One question, you talked about collecting and the reporting of post-secondary data. Has that been, I don't know where the noise is coming from, but I don't know if it's a phone or it sounds like a mic that's getting hit. Mm-hmm. So anyway, has that been a part of your agency from the beginning?
The last legislature made that change. It was original.
Not getting better, is it? Maybe it's the same people that stole my gavel. Okay. Mute.
Mr. Chairman, the original federal grant went to K-12, to the Department of K-12, but the legislature decided either last year or the year before, I think the year before, to have it reside in the Office of Higher Ed. And I think part of the reasoning is the K-12 system is about 92% public institutions, whereas post-secondary, there's a lot of non-public players, and we already had agreements with all of those players to provide data. And so, like, you know, all the St. Thomas always provided us data because we have relationships with them. So I think the legislature kind of decided, since we're talking about both public and non-public institutions, that maybe the Office of Higher Ed was a better place to have it located. So, and we're just the lead agency, but we work closely with K-12, D, and in the future, presumably, other agencies, you know, Human Services and other agencies. But that's off in the future. Just wanted to point out that we have enhanced, I've been there about two and a half years, and it became apparent that because of the increased cost of post-secondary education that we probably should up the agency's work in the student advocacy area or consumer protection area. It used to be that you basically were left to, the Attorney General had to sue somebody if there was a problem. So we've assigned a consumer advocate to take student complaints and try to work with institutions to resolve that before it gets to that point. So we've upped our activity in that area, and it's been well received. We just did it within our own resources. Finally, there's all kinds of reports available and websites. We have a website where all of this stuff is on. We just finished a big developmental education report that was the first use of this longitudinal SLEDS data. Oh, I'm supposed to be pushing this. Maybe I ought to pull up and do it soon. This longitudinal data, and just a primer, we used to talk as if 46% of Minnesota high school graduates needed remedial or developmental work. Now that we're looked at the longitudinal data, we know it's closer to 28%. It's just better data now. And if we include the non-public schools, high schools, which we don't yet have, we think it's probably closer to 25%. So this data system is going to give better information for you to work with. We just finished, it'll be available tonight or tomorrow morning, something called an Intervention for College Attendance Program Evaluation. This legislature had given us some money to do that over the years, and we evaluate that every 2 years. Things that are pending is an update of this Minnesota Measures, which is kind of a document that has all the data, all the charts of everything about post-secondary. It's all online. We are about to release a big report on retention completion that is about the challenge. Minnesota has a we're not doing as, we have very great, good access to post-secondary because we have open enrollment institutions at Minscu, but we are lagging nationally in actually graduating all of those students, partially because we let everybody gets a chance. So we've done a report to say, what are the best practices going on in retention and completion? How should we maybe, how you should maybe consider accelerating that for everybody? We were asked by the legislature to make some proposals related to student loan refinancing. That'll be ready by February 1st. The legislature also asked us to put up some information on study abroad. That website has been developed. We'll be reporting on how we developed it and recommendations for the legislature at your request to what other regulations you might consider. And finally, the legislature asked us to continue work on institutional metrics, which means in English, what are some measures you might use as policymakers to judge whether the post-secondary institutions are successfully doing whatever they say they're doing. So that's all on the office itself, Mr. Chairman and members. I wanted then just a general overview, and this is from my perspective or the office's perspective. Others may have different perspectives. But we think the three major kind of policy areas the legislature has put a stake down in over the years is, one, the 35-mile rule. In the 60s, the legislature basically decided to make a post-secondary institution, this is about 1963, make a post-secondary institution available to everybody within 35 miles of their home. And that is why we're one of the few, I don't know, we're one of the states that has quite a bit of infrastructure in people's neighborhoods, basically, around the state. We see some consolidation of that now, where you maybe have two locations that are under one campus. But generally, we pretty much have a post-secondary institution, public institution, within 35 miles of every citizen in the state. Pretty close. The second general policy the state has is under 135A, and it's kind of got three components. One is the legislature says it's going to provide stable funding for post-secondary education, and that state and students should share the cost. So there's some notion of shared responsibility for post-secondary, a private good and a public good. And then finally, the legislature intends that the legislature would provide 67% of the funding for a student, basically. There's some complexities there, but that's the policy. And just to kind of give you a feel for that, the legislature and the governor would have had to appropriate $1.4 billion more last biennium to reach that 67%. So we are short of that policy that the legislature has set out. Then the final is in about 1971. Student choice, particularly for economically disadvantaged students, that they pick kind of their best fit institution for post-secondary. So kind of the way I read the statutes is those are kind of the three policies or the three overall framework things that the legislature over the years has set out. Now just the general landscape. 70% of Minnesota high school students attend Minnesota post-secondary institutions. That's about 440,000 students, and that includes post-secondary enrollment students as well as graduate and online students. There's about $195 million in need-based financial aid, and that's state grant, child care, Indian scholarships, GI Bill, and state work study. And the state grant serves about 100,000 students in Minnesota. On the subsidized Minnesota self-loan, when I say subsidized, it was done with a kind of bonding that allows you to have lower interest rates on the loans. And it's a good option after the federal subsidized loan. So it's better than parent, for those of you who have children who are going through this, it's better than parent loans. And certainly better than private loans if you just go down to Wells Fargo. So it's kind of in there. It's a good option for students once they've exhausted their lowest cost federal loans or their lowest federal loans, priced federal loans. And we have about 9,400 loans were put out in 13-14. But there's over the years, I don't know what the number is, but there's probably 60 or 70,000 loans outstanding that people are paying back. Minnesota ranks high in the number of people aged 25 to 34 who have an associate degree or higher. That's one of the aspects of Minnesota. We're a pretty high-attaining state. We're second in the nation. Next slide, Minnesota, 70% go on to post-secondary, and this chart shows that about out of that 70%, 67% go to Minnesota Institute. About that 67% enroll, then the light line, which is about 45%, goes to Minnesota institutions, and then roughly 20% is the number that go to out-of-state institutions. Madison, North Dakota State, Harvard. And that's been pretty consistent. About 20% of our students go out-of-state. The state grant, none of our subsidized activity goes to those students. They can't take their state grant out of Minnesota. What institutions do those students attend? And you can see that most of them attend MinSCU campuses, and most of them attend two-year campuses.
Commissioner, can I interrupt for a minute?
Absolutely.
We do have, first of all, before the question, I neglected to tell you at the beginning of our hearing that we are on TV. So keep smiling. And Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, I was just curious as to those that are going out of state for education, are they coming back to Minnesota for work, or are they staying out of state? Do you happen to know?
I don't think we know precisely, but over the years, and we hope to figure that out through longitudinal data analysis, but over the years, Minnesota has been considered a brain importer, and so we do think most of those students, some large percentage of them, do come back. Particularly if they go to like North Dakota or Wisconsin. So historically, we think most come back, but I don't think we precisely know.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. And Commissioner, I know that millennials are tending to leave our state, and I'm just trying to figure out, you know, maybe the longitudinal study will bear this out more so, but do you know when that longitudinal study is completed so we know kind of these folks, if they're coming back, or you know, really coming back or not? Or
it'll take a while. We will have to start to have agreements with other states to share data, because we won't know if they're working in a job in another state. So it'll take a while, but I would guess probably, you know, within the next 4, 5, 6 years around the country, those data systems will be developed in a way where we can precisely answer that question.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay. Representative Christensen.
Commissioner, do we have data on, thanks, Mr. Chair, on which students attend out-of-state schools in border states or maybe just states that have reciprocity versus states or who travel further afield?
We do.
Commissioner,
we do.
Thank
and
you.
If you want that broken down a little, we'll try to get you something.
That'd be great. I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. We know precisely how many students take reciprocity,
right,
and then we can kind of back into that number.
Thanks.
Any other questions since we've paused here for a minute?
That chart just shows you which institutions people attend. And again, I think the bottom line there is most post-secondary students are in the MinSCU system. Enrollment by race. And there are two things to notice on this chart. The orange and the yellowish, or the kind of the light red and orange, those are two-year students, and the blue are four-year students. And you can see just something to note here that I notice is that for African-American students, the bulk of them go to two-year programs, and a large number are part-time. That's what this chart can tell you. By race, what kind of are they part-time, full-time, and what kind of institution do they go to? And this later on, I'm going to make this point, but this chart is something you look at to talk about the very significant socioeconomic segmentation that goes on in post-secondary institution about what types of institutions do students attend. And it's pretty dramatic in Minnesota. It's in every state, but it's pretty dramatic in Minnesota. The next chart is developmental education. We just did this with the SLEDS data. It was the first product of the SLEDS data. Again, we thought it was 46% roughly. That's what people talked about. We know it's 28%. The latest data, the new data that we're going to have in the next week or two from the latest bound, that 28% will be 27%. And the way to think about this is then about, it does not include non-public high schools, for example, so it's maybe closer to 25% once we get data from them. But that's still one in four students, when they go into post-secondary in Minnesota, take one or two developmental courses or remedial courses, and it's usually in math or reading. And post-secondary people would like that to be zero, right? They would like it to be every student is ready to go when they get here. Developmental education enrollment. This then breaks down a little bit where those students, that one in four, end up going, and it's heavily to Minnesota two-year public colleges. That's the 85%. That's the point of this chart. The reason those developmental students are probably not at St. Thomas or the University of Minnesota is because they have entrance requirements. And so they don't exactly screen people out, but if you have higher ACT score, the odds of you taking developmental remedial are just lower. And so that's the difference between those institutions and a Minsku two-year or four-year campus, which is open enrollment. So kind of the way I think about it, we always need to think of the Minsku campuses as being totally accessible, but with kind of the largest challenge in terms of preparedness.
Commissioner, we have a question for you. Representative Barrett.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Just a quick question regarding slide 11. You mentioned 28% need remedial education. Do you have that broken down by any other selection, I guess, either by school district, area of the state?
Yes, gender. The answer is yes.
Anything pronounced that you might want to share with the committee regarding that?
Holger Miller.
You know, I don't want to jump too far, but we do have it through this SLEDS thing that we've got out there now. You can look at, matter of fact, we did this. Oh, did we hand this out? You might want to look at this. This is a start. This is something called an for younger people know what this is. I didn't know what it was. It's called an infographic. And it's an attempt to summarize data in an accurate way, in a way that people would like to read it. And so the short answer to your question is, through the SEDS, we have a data analytics. So on your iPad or on your phone, you can literally go in, and we did this, I think, earlier today with Kennedy High School. That's in your right. community. You can literally go in and look at Kennedy High School in your community, whichever community you have, and find out how many students took remedial. And where did they go? So the answer is, yeah, it's pretty detailed.
Representative Barrett.
Quick follow-up. So do you know yourself and anything you could share with the committee about what that information has told you and where we need to improve in K-12 education to help reduce that number?
One thing that's real clear is language is a big factor. For example, within the African-American number, yes, you can see there's a little piece of the infographic here. A subset in the African-American number you would look at would be Somali. And there's some sense that that's really a language issue. So that's exactly the kind of thing that we want people to think about, ask, and we'll try to get you an answer.
Thank you.
We did that. Next kind of major landscape issue is affordability and debt.
We're on page 13.
Page 13. Between 2002 and 2012, tuition increased about three times the rate of inflation in family incomes. We're now starting to turn that tide here, but that was kind of this big expansion of price in post-secondary during that period. Minnesota tends to be on the higher income of tuition to all kinds of institutions nationally. So our two-year tuition, which is a little like $5,300, is a little higher than in a lot of other states. I think the national average might be $3,000 or $4,000. But that's also at the University of Minnesota and at some of the private colleges. So Minnesota just tends to be a little higher price than other states. Minnesota students have higher debt compared to other students nationally, but we have lower default rates. So we have a higher income state generally, and so people tend to be willing to pay higher prices for post-secondary. They tend to be willing to take out a little more debt, and they appear to be able to pay it back. The median debt for bachelor's degree was $26,800 in Minnesota. About 70% of students take out debt on the bachelor track, and that is slightly down from previous years. This is median, not average. Average is a little higher, but median is more reflective of, if I think about my own child, what would it be? Because the average debt, there are just some people who take on a lot more debt than they should have. So we like to think about it in terms of median debt. So that's kind of what it costs to get a bachelor's degree in Minnesota, the amount of debt for 70% of people.
Commissioner, we have a question from Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Pogemiller, I'm wondering if you have any information about student attitudes towards debt and their ability to pay it off in the future. Because obviously if you're willing to take out loans to get a degree that generates income for you, then you're able to pay it back and there are low default rates. That's kind of a deal that works. There might be problems with it in a number of ways, but at least if you feel like you have the chance of getting a job that's going to pay it back, you might find it worth investing in your education in that way. The question is, though, if people feel like they're going to be able to ever pay it back, because that can have a dramatic effect on behavior. So I wonder if there is data that you have as an organization, or if you're aware of any other data nationally that would tell us whether people still think the debt is worth it.
Commissioner Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, let's pull us out the latest kind of. Gallup did something at some point recently that I can't just pull off the numbers. So we'll pull something together for you. What we do know, what basically in post-secondary kind of the rule of thumb is, don't take out more debt than what you're going to get paid the first year out of college. And the research is overwhelming and continues to be overwhelming, even through this big run-up in price, that the post-secondary premium, if you get a certificate or a degree, not just attendance, but if you actually get a degree, or the post-secondary premium is still there. It is worth it. But let's pull out some information about what people's attitudes are right now. Because that affects the choice they make on college they go to. It affects whether they choose to go to college.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify for the record, I actually don't think that $26,800 in average debt for a bachelor's degree is something that we should be happy with and satisfied with. But the point is, people often are willing to do it if they feel like there's hope for the future.
We have another question from Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, I had a meeting earlier this week, and I was told that about 17,000 are currently in default of student loan debt. And I'm wondering if you happen to know how that ranks here in Minnesota nationally.
I think we know that answer. I don't have it right with me. We'll see if we can give you that today. But we've done a study on that activity, and maybe we should be, what do we know? We know that the default rate in Minnesota overall is 14%. Let me just make sure. No, Minnesota is 12%, and the national is 14%. At the for-profits, or proprietaries, Minnesota is 13%. Nationally, it's 19%. At private four-year not-for-profits, St. Thomas, 5% in Minnesota, 7% nationally. For public four-year, so Minsku four-year and U of M, it's 5% for Minnesota and 9% nationally. And for public two-year, it's 18% public and 21% non-public.
Thank you,
Paul. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you.
National. No, 21% national.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I just have a quick follow-up, too. So do you have also some statistics on those that are behind but not necessarily in full default?
Commissioner
Pogemiller. 30, 60, 90 days.
I think we don't know that.
Okay. Is that something that you could obtain for us to see where people are kind of in that danger zone but haven't quite hit default so we can actually do some intervention?
We'll see what we can find out. I don't know. We advise people because if you have federal loans, mm-hmm. You shouldn't default. You should just say, income-based repayment. And so kind of the talk in higher ed is we just got to make sure people know about that. Because most of the money out there is federal loans. The amount of private loans has really, I forget what year the feds did this, but they kind of made it hard for people to take out private loans. People do, but.
Right, and I'm guessing maybe the message isn't getting out if we have 12% that are currently in default. That's still pretty high. I know it's lower than the national average, but if they don't need to be in default because they can it's based on their income, then I think that we're not doing a very good job communicating that.
And that is that the public two-year or public, the biggest, the 18%?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the largest issue there is the public two-year.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at slide 13, and you've got bachelor's and associate's. Do you have anything for graduate work?
Commissioner Pogamiller?
I guess we do.
Wow, that's impressive.
Master's degree, 33.7. Doctoral degree, 64,000. First professional, this is where the big numbers are, 138,400.
And Representative,
and is that including the bachelor's in that, or is that just the graduate by itself?
By itself, we think by itself. We'll verify.
So in addition to the condition, yeah. Okay, thank you.
If that's wrong, I will get back to you. But we believe that's right.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Pogamiller, I was going to ask you about this first professional, kind of what the definition of that is. But I'm also, the reason I asked to be recognized is to ask if you have, and maybe somebody else here does, comparative information about debt defaults on other kinds of debt. How often do people default on mortgages and go into foreclosure? What are the rates on other kinds of debt defaults? Because, I think it's instructive to compare not just how we do compared to other states, but in general whether education debt is something that people can carry in a similar fashion that they can carry other forms of debt. So I'm guessing you don't have that, but
we'll see if we can pull something together.
Okay. And then what is the first professional?
First professional in 2013, 138,400.
What does that mean, Mr. Chair? What does the first professional mean?
Lawyer, doctor. It's a lot.
MBA?
MBA would be a master's
level.
Any other questions?
I don't.
That's it? Oh, Representative Bernardi.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. You said that we're a little bit higher for a two-year college. You know, it was like 5,300, and you said that the national average is 3,000 to 4,000.
That's what's in my head, but we tend to be higher than the national average.
Because that seems a lot higher to me. If you do it percentage-wise, it seems like it's a lot higher.
There may be somebody in the audience that can give us that exact number. Do we know the number? Oh. 3,600 is the national average, and we're at 5,681.
Wow. Yeah, Mr. Chair, just that seems like it's, this seems like it's a lot higher. Maybe I'm electrifying this thing. I don't know. It seems like it's a lot higher.
Then, Mr. Chairman,
we have one other question before we continue, and. We're still not trying to figure out where that static's coming from. I think it's Knobloch's microphone, but
pull it out.
Mr. Chairman, he's new to the legislature.
But the technician pulled it off earlier, and that's why you can disconnect that, see if that makes a difference.
Yeah,
that makes
sense.
Also, be sure you're not kicking underneath the desk where the wires are. So, Representative Bernardi.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to mention, you know, some people are new and they don't realize that if their phone is just on, that it makes that noise. So I just want to make sure everybody knows that their phone has to be totally off to prevent that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the third committee hearing I've had in this room today, and this is the first time we've had that problem. Sorry, Commissioner, we have this technical issue. But, can you mute that one? See if that helps, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Hold it down.
Yes.
Doesn't seem to be. Well, let's proceed, and if it happens again, just we'll have Jim push the button down. Representative Bernardi, were you finished?
Yeah, that was
okay.
It. Thank you.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do you have any information on
I know you say here Minnesota students have higher debt as compared to other students nationally. Do you have any quantifiable data in terms of where we rank nationally? You know, what that difference is between other states, not just for debt, but also tuition?
We usually rank fourth or fifth, Mr. Chairman, fourth or fifth in the nation. But slight caveat, we tend to be a higher income state.
Okay. I guess,
Mr. Chairman, then with regards to bachelor's, either through information or just the price being frozen, we're making some progress there. That's coming down slightly. For the associate degree, it's actually going up slightly. The legislature in the last couple of years, legislature and the governor, put about $200 million into direct aid with the tuition freezes and state grants. And that the data is showing that that clearly had an impact.
Just to interrupt, if there's somebody up maybe in the gallery that has a cell phone on, if we could ask you to turn it off and see if that fixes the problem. I think the members have theirs turned off. It's just unusual. I've started at this hour and not earlier today. So, sorry about the interruption, Commissioner, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll plug along here.
The next two charts have some complexities, but and they're estimates, so don't say this is my child. What it tries to do is, we use these sheets when we go out and talk to families about, when you're thinking about post-secondary, here's how you ought to think about the price. And what this chart says, it tries to incorporate the sources of paying for post-secondary, tuition and fees, Pell Grant, state grant, and scholarships from colleges, which are either buy-downs from their price. If you go to a private college, most of them buy down the price. The net, it's called the net price. Or they give scholarships based on merit or need. So with all of these things are trying to be incorporated here, what this first chart says is that if your family, if through all the calculations, your family basically has a low enough income that there's no expectation that the family chip in. So that's what this EFC, family contribution. So if you're in the roughly if you're in the $30,000-$40,000 range of adjusted gross income, this is what the numbers look like for you. At a community college, tuition's about $5,300. That's the little blue portion. This is the first one. And then what living expenses are, travel to and from, all of that, is roughly estimated to be $13,000. And then the next column is grants. You can see that through the Pell and state grants and institutional grants, you can get more than tuition and fees. It starts to pay for some of your extra expenses. And you think about the extra expenses as being the trade-off between studying versus working. If you have to study, you probably have less time to work. And we care about that because of the completion issue. If you spend too much time working, usually we think about anything over 20 hours, it eats into your ability to concentrate on studying. So then the same calculations for state universities, University of Minnesota, and private colleges. And you'll note on the private college one, that large scholarship from college, that light green, that's what happens in the private college sector. They basically buy down most students from the price they put out publicly. And, people normally think that's a bit of a game going on, but that's what goes on.
Commissioner, we have another question. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do you have information, say, from the last, 10 years? We kind of discussed this a little bit yesterday. But from the last 10 years in terms of the levels of support that students from the different systems are getting from these different scholarships, grants?
Mr. Chairman, I think the intent is to have us come back and talk a lot about state grants and stuff, and I think we'll give you a lot of information around that topic. We don't have as much information, but we can maybe do some estimates about how much do the institutions themselves put in. We have some information, but since they're all kind of private packages, we can't totally understand what's going on. We have some estimates. So if you're willing to defer, we'll make that part of that presentation.
Representative Lean.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. You know, your best estimates would be much appreciated.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then, so then the next chart is, if you have a family that's in the $70,000 adjusted gross income range, which means the family's expected to put about $6,000 in under the federal calculation, these are what the numbers look like. And one of the things to notice about this chart is Pell starts to run out as you go up the income range, but the state grant fills in for that lower middle income family. And
it's getting worse. I think we're off the air. Not quite, but close. Well, again, I don't know what we can do about the noise. I apologize for
we try to work through it?
To speak up loud.
Okay. And this is something that when we have the state grant discussion, we'll be more explicit about. But the state grant is a complement to the Pell Grant. It's not a supplement. So it's not just an add-on to Pell. It's in the context of a larger policy of shared responsibility. And that's kind of what this chart shows a little bit. The state grant really gets you into the lower middle income range better than Pell does. Not better, it's just, it's designed to do that. So now some larger issues in post-secondary, or just larger numbers. This is the trend line on revenue and appropriations. And the dotted lines are appropriations per student, and the solid lines are revenue per student. And you note that Minnesota is the blue, and it is higher, it's historically higher than the U.S. total on revenue per student. Combination of appropriations and tuition. We're a higher tuition state, that's why that number is higher than the national. And then on appropriations, where the U.S. appropriations per student are higher than Minnesota's.
We have a question from Representative Bernardi.
And I'm going backwards, but I just wanted to know, at what point is a family, what kind of income would they expect to, that they would cover the whole cost of education?
It depends, Mr. Chairman. It depends what type of institution you go to. And it's only usually at a two-year college or a public two-year college or a public four-year college, not the University of Minnesota. It's not possible to get a Pell and a state grant that meets the university's level. But at a public four-year, if your income is low enough, public four-year and a two-year, that is possible.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
My
Bernardi.
Question was really, it was like the opposite. At what point in time do families, when does the aid and assistance like cut off?
Commissioner Pogamiller?
We think it's roughly 60,000 adjusted income for the Pell and 80,000 to 90,000 adjusted income for the state grant.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, then, sure. on any chart that shows you revenue or appropriations relative per student, you need to keep in mind that
it's reminding us of it's a thunderstorm, I think. Not really.
Increases in student population tend to drive down per student appropriations. More students, and if you're appropriating, there's, you know, we're spending less per student. Decreases in student enrollment drive up. So some of that is external to what you're actually doing. That's just a caveat when you look at per student kind of numbers. Next chart, 17, is higher ed appropriations from 96 till now. You can see total. You can see MNSCU and the U, interestingly, track almost the same. So it appears there's kind of a legislative policy, either inadvertently or on purpose, to give the same kind of money to the two type, the university and Minsky. Again, I don't know if that's explicit or whether it just kind of works out that way, but that data shows that that's kind of what's happening. And then the state grant is that yellow line, and you can see it moves up a little, and in 13 and 14 it popped up a lot. And just for purposes of administrative costs at our office, you can see that that's pretty flat, and gosh, that's low. That was a little editorial point. The next chart is now this chart of higher ed appropriations per FTE. This is a chart where it's mostly, you just need to understand just remember that this is largely dependent on what's going on with the student population. Because you don't change your appropriations that much. It's up a little or down a little. But student populations can change pretty dramatically because of the two-year colleges. When the economy tanks or goes down, a lot of people come back to two-year colleges for education. The numbers go up dramatically. Now we're seeing declining enrollment at the two-year colleges, and that's mostly because the economy's gotten better. It doesn't generally have anything to do with what MinSKU is doing or not doing. It's something they can't control. They just have to try to deal with what's happening outside of their control. And this chart, just the caveat, this chart is partially reflective of that up and down of that number. Education equity. There's been a lot of discussion about this, and this is just a chart that shows the participation rate by race in Minnesota. And the reason we like to point this out is because the growing part of Minnesota population is non-white. So if these trends continue, it seems like that's a problem for our state. We need to try to have more similar results for racial groups in Minnesota. It just seems like that would be a wise thing to do. Otherwise, we'll tend to, that's not, our growth in population is people of color. Similar chart with regards to the attainment gap. The first one was who goes to post-secondary. The second one is who graduates, who gets a two-year degree in at least 3 years, or who gets a four-year degree in at least 6 years. When people talk about on-time graduation, they sometimes are talking about 4 years for a four-year degree and sometimes talking about 2 years for a two-year degree, but a lot of times they're talking about 3 years for a two-year degree and 4 years for a, or 6 years for a four-year degree. So you need to pay attention when they talk to you, which number are you talking about. So that you can see the disparities there among students. SLEDS, then, I explained it's a database, or a tool is the way I like to think about it, that is in development, and we're starting to get initial results from that. And the whole idea is to identify system predictors for long-term individual success and help you differentiate between what works, what doesn't work, and then make appropriate investments. It's designed for improvement strategies and to kind of improve data-driven decision making.
We have a question. Representative Norton.
Thank you. And Commissioner, I don't think this will come as a surprise, but having attended the Complete College event this year, it was really disappointing that of the 37 states, there are 36 of them provided all the data needed to compare ourselves, and Minnesota did not. We were the one state that did not. But we have invested in tools. You clearly have lots of information. Is this something that, I guess I'm looking for help in how we're going to get that data to folks like Complete College so we can have apples-to-apples comparisons?
Commissioner Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, to some extent, it's dependent on the institutions to do that. And obviously, if there's a strong enough signal from the legislature that you want that done, we will kind of try to facilitate that as best as possible. But I would ask you to at least give the institutions a chance to talk to you about whether the cost benefit of that makes sense or not for them. But the more SLEDS data we get, then they can be taken. They don't even need to be in the loop. We can maybe just do it for them.
Thank you. And that's, Mr. Chair, that's sort of what I'm getting at. And I will talk a little bit more about what we saw at the Complete College as we move ahead in the coming months. But It does make it very difficult, and I do think we've invested in something that can provide that information if we continue to invest and broaden the scope a little bit rather than pull back on it, because 36 states did it. We were the only one that could not.
And Mr. Chairman,
Pogemiller.
I think the institutions would be thrilled if they said, oh, you guys can do that at OE? Great. Thank you. Institutions get asked by a lot of different people to give information. And they are, I think it's fair to say, they generally are making a choice between, do we want to put resources into that, or do we want to put resources into what we think internally we need to do what we have to do? So I think we're getting there. But it's been it is a challenge. So SLEDs, there are things out there. They're out on the web. There's a Getting Prepared report. And then there's graduate employment outcomes, where we use DEED data, unemployment insurance data, tied it to higher ed data to say what happened to people. And at first, we can do that for a year or two right now, but eventually we'll be able to do it over a 10-year period. The post-secondary institutions are a little concerned that if we only show the first year or two out, it doesn't give the full picture of what happens to college graduates. So we'll get there. Over the next few years, we'll get to a point where the post-secondary institutions will be okay with this kind of data analysis too. They just, particularly the four-year colleges, are a little, they just would like you to know that looking just 2 years out isn't good enough, because there's real good data around the country that 5 or 8 or 10 years out, there absolutely is a premium on getting a bachelor's degree. But within a few years, when we get the longitudinal data, we'll either say, yep, that's true, or no, they overestimated that. But it'll take a few years to get there.
I have another question, just interrupt for a moment. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I just was curious as to this data that you're receiving, does it also include the degrees that they got from the four-year university?
Yes. Great. Oh. We are not able, Mr.
Commissioner,
we know what degrees they got, I think, don't we? What we don't know, we can't break down the unemployment insurance or the employment data with enough granularity to see if there's a match. There's fairly broad categories what businesses report to the agency, the unemployment insurance, and it would be good to get an agreement from business to provide more granular data. And I think the way we need to think about that is when they think it's in their interest to have more granular data, they will want to provide that. But I think we're not maybe there yet, because it would be a data requirement issue for business. And we kind of know by industry, but we don't know. I think the general thing is we kind of know by industry, but we don't know by direct occupation right now. But it would be good to get there, but that would take more reporting from the private sector.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So do you have any information thus far as to degrees? You know, they got a psychology degree. I have a bachelor's in applied psychology. And how many of them are unemployed after 1 or 2 years?
We have some.
Pogemiller.
Yes. Can we pull that one out right now? We have data like that, and we'll get you something.
Would you please? Thank you.
Particularly psychology?
Well, that just happens to be one of the lowest returns on investment, let's just say. I think it's $37,000 per year average salary for a bachelor's degree in psychology.
We'll work on something like that, and I would, if you have time, and you may not, you might want to go to this website and see if you can find that, because it was hopefully designed in a way where mere humans can find that kind of data.
Thank you.
And you might be a test case for us about, can somebody find this or not? But that website, it's out on the website, and you maybe want to, if you have some time, examine it.
Thank you.
And then the last point is there's mobile analytics here, so all of this stuff is iPad, cell phone available. And we tried to design it that way so that, again, citizens and mere humans can get at this information. Then just briefly on the state grant, and again, I'm sure we'll be back to discuss the nuances of all this, but it's a need-based grant. You use the federal FAFSA, and about 86% of the students who are going to college actually complete the FAFSA, so we have high completion rate. A lower number actually goes to college, so I think in the end it's something like 52 or 58% of high school students fill out the FAFSA. But those who are going to college almost everybody, 86% fill out the FAFSA. You know, if you're Bill Gates' kid, you maybe don't fill it out. But pretty much everybody else fills it out. One-third of undergraduate, one-third of Minnesota students attending Minnesota institutions receive a grant, state grant. So it's pretty broad-based. And then we had mentioned before, it's about $178 million. In 04, the legislature, we really appreciate, gave a 15% increase to kind of to deal with this ramp up in price over the last decade. And this helped get there. And we hope to finish that job this year. I hope to be back here explaining that's what the governor's trying to do. So we're talking, in 04, there were 175,000 applicants. Almost 100,000 were recipients of the state grant. Again, it's a shared responsibility model that is not a supplement, it's a complement to the Pell, and it is based on the cost of attendance, which is both tuition fees and living expenses. And then we split that out, once you do the calculations, basically the student has a 50% responsibility, and then once you split it all out, you split the cost between the student, their current income and their future income, families, and the taxpayers through Pell or state grant. And we'll come back and explain all of that in a way that's understandable, hopefully. Here's just the data of the distribution of your $178 million state grant money. It is in the lower ranges, which you'd expect in terms of family income. These are adjusted gross again, not your income, but your adjusted gross. But it gets up, you know, you've got quite a few people up to 80,000 or more who are getting some state grant. Smaller grants as you move up, but still they're getting something. The other thing that will become a nuance later, for the lowest income, they might not get as big a state of grant as somebody in a higher income, and that's because their Pell took care of most of that. So they don't need a higher state grant under the Minnesota Shared Responsibility Formula. Again, complement to Pell, and I'll talk about that later, versus a supplement. The red is the Pell, the state, the blue is where the state grant goes by income. And again, you can see in the upper incomes, you literally get more state grant than Pell grant. And the Minnesota system is set up that way. Next chart, combined federal and state. It has what you would say, what I think you would say from a technical point of view, is a nice distribution. It tends to go down as family adjusted income. The combined Pell and state grant tends to go down as adjusted family income goes up. Finally, here are kind of the challenges that we think people are talking about. Debt load, obviously, we need to continue to do work there. Retention and completion, I had mentioned that we are very good in Minnesota of getting people into post-secondary. We need to be a little more intentional and good at making sure they get a degree or certificate. Because the premium issue for higher ed is not attendance. It's degree or certificate. That's when you get your premium.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Commissioner, when you say the premium issue, is that also related to the two-year college?
Yes. There's a wage premium for that also. Absolutely. Matter of fact, in the short term,
please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, in the short term, there's growing evidence, and we hope to nail this down, where a two-year degree or a certificate, at least in the short term, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, is probably a better choice for some people than a baccalaureate.
Absolutely. Representative Isaac, I think that I have a slightly different take on how we're assessing that. My concern would be that oftentimes what is deemed a success is a degree in a two-year college, and that students that don't finish the degree but go on to their bachelor aren't qualified and aren't a part of the rubric of what was a successful student experience at a community college. And that, I think, skews the numbers of what was going on. You know, so I have many students that come through, I teach a century, that come through that are moving on to a four-year degree, and then they don't go through the graduation process because they don't need to finish the classes because they've already been accepted. Yet the school is kind of on the hook for that person not having completed their degree. And that doesn't provide for the same, you know, incentive for that community. At the same time, I do agree, many folks are well served by the two-year degree by itself and certificate, so I'm not at all saying that isn't good, but I hope that higher education will look at how we assess the success of our community colleges, because if it is a vehicle that launches them to the next level of professional or academic world,
and creates that success, whether they actually attain the certificate or not, I think is something to be considered as part of the positive.
Yes.
Commissioner Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, we are getting better at doing exactly what you said, because if someone transfers to another program, you want to take that out of the non-completion rate. And we're getting much better at that, and I think even when you do that, there's some evidence that we have work to do on retention and completion in Minnesota. But it's usually not as bad as people think it is, but it still could use some work.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, just kind of tied to this. Do we have numbers, and I suspect you do, but we hear a lot about the articulation issues between a two-year and a four-year. I've had somebody tell me, well, it shouldn't be that big of a deal because not that many students go from a two- and four-year. So I would personally be interested in knowing how many of our students that go to a two-year, whether they have that certificate or not, how many of them go on from a two-year institution to a four-year institution and actually graduate, because I think there's some misconceptions perhaps out there.
Commissioner Pogue.
Exactly, and we're getting better data on that exact point, and we'll get you whatever we think we know now. But that it's absolutely true. There is more and more students starting in the two-year path and then moving to a four-year path than there used to be. And institutionally, MNSCU, as an example, is trying to make that more seamless. And I think it's making progress.
Representative Winkler, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Pogamiller, I wanted to zero in on workforce for a minute. According to Steve Hine at Deed, something like 49% of Minnesotans who are working in a job that is that requires less education or skill than they possess. And at the same time, we continue to hear from employers that they can't find workers with the skill sets they need. So either somebody is wrong about their numbers or we have a pretty significant mismatch going on between what we're educating students for and what the jobs actually require. And on top of that, we have record debt levels, we have high tuition, and we have students essentially taking a high-stakes gamble that what they're studying is somehow going to pay off. And so your bottom bullet point seems to me not just a question of replacing baby boomers or meeting workforce emerging needs, but also guiding students into making decisions about their education that might have some relationship to the workforce ahead. And I know some work has been going on, but I wonder if you could highlight, not because I don't, it's not just a MNSCU issue, this is a higher education issue in general, and it reaches into K-12 obviously, so I wonder if you could just talk about some ways we might be able to take care of that.
Commissioner Pogamiller.
Chairman, I do think that you very well articulated the whole set of issues there, and I wish there were straightforward, simple answers, because this kind of is cyclical. When the economy's bad, we notice this a lot more than we. But there's clearly still a lot of underemployment because of the recession we just went through, and that's starting to correct itself. But this mismatch issue, there's a lot of disagreement in post-secondary. For example, Mr. Hines would argue that that's mostly a, I don't know if he'd say mostly, but he says in a large part that's a pricing issue. If you paid more, there'd be less of a mismatch. But I think in post-secondary, they want to be matched up with the workforce. And I think, I'm guessing there'll be a lot of activity around that issue this year after the governor's budget comes out. So the governor's trying to address it. I think the business partnership's trying to address it. MNSCU's trying to address it. MNSCU had, I think, 55 meetings over the last couple of years to talk about that exact issue. Are we doing what you need us to do, employers? And I think people are trying, but I don't think anybody's totally figured out how to resolve it all yet.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I guess I want to just be clear that I'm not talking about sort of custom making an education according to business demands. I'm talking about giving students better understanding about what they're studying and whether those classes and the work that they're doing in class actually has some relationship to. I mean, you can't custom train everybody to a field that you don't know exists, right? So you have to give them some education and some training and some skills and basic abilities that will allow them to be flexible, but it still has to be somewhat relevant to general areas. So the real question is more about how are we guiding students into making better decisions with these big dollar amounts that we're insisting that they spend and borrow?
Commissioner Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, the way I think about it is, you've got at the 2-year level and certificate level, you got more employers saying they need more kind of liberal arts stuff. They need to know how to work in groups. They're getting the technical, but they need more liberal artsy stuff, work in groups, all that. On the baccalaureate level, you're getting people saying, well, they don't know how to do anything real. And so I think they're kind of coming together a little bit, and we're starting to look, we need to look for ways to provide both experiential learning and baccalaureate learning in a way that students feel they've gotten the shortest and best path to be prepared for what employers are asking for. And I think they're all working on that. I think people are trying. But I think there's actually a call for more kind of liberal arts stuff in people's educations, regardless of what level they're at, because you don't know if the jobs are going to be 10 years from now. What we'll find out with SLED's data will be this informational piece. It'll say to people, here's what happened. Here's the education somebody took. Here's the job they have. And people then can start to assess, is that the path I want to be on? Do I want to wait 15 years, or do I want to do something a little earlier? We do know some things, right? People in upper management jobs tend to have baccalaureates. Whether that's necessary or not, I guess we all have to, do you need to be a lawyer to do certain things? I mean, I was hiring a summer ago, and because of all the underemployment, I could hire a lawyer in addition to the other things. So, is that person underemployed, or is that person...
Commissioner, they are, definitely.
So, anyway, I'm not trying to evade. I don't have the answer, Representative. I'm just saying that with SLED's data, we're trying to figure out more about what works, what doesn't, so people can make judgments. And I just guarantee you, every hired institution, proprietary, public, non-public, they're all trying to unravel that exact question. What makes sense to people we would like to come here and pay these prices?
We are closing in on the closing of this hearing, but Representative Norton, you have a question?
I would just add to this conversation that one of the things colleges are looking at across the country, and commissioners aware of this, is providing more flexibility with meta majors so that the classes that you take count for a broader number of options that you choose later on. And also, which kind of goes against the grain a little bit, but for those beginning students, less choice in their coursework so they don't waste so much money taking courses that perhaps don't go anywhere, aren't transferable. So there are some things that are being done around the country that hopefully we'll look at later and maybe see if Minnesota should be delving into that a little bit more.
Representative Isaacson, I think you were on the list.
Commissioner, going back to what Representative Winkler was speaking about, I disagree slightly with him about the idea of customizing, but I think that my experience in having to work bills that involve both the market and then also higher education, one of the problems that I'm seeing, especially on the 2-year level, is that there just isn't enough room for colleges to be nimble in responding to market needs, right? You still have kids who think that there's a certain degree they want, they go get that degree regardless if that degree's been saturated, and we're not stopping them because they all are registering and paying their tuition. And then they come out and they have the degree and they can't go. And so, and not that I think that you should be responding every semester with a new analysis based on business reports, but I think that especially at a 2-year school, we have a lot more of an accountability because people are coming right out of there into where there is a need. And so you look at the manufacturing shortfall that we have right now, and just to get a bill that would work on getting folks streamlined between a job and some college education was a major overhaul and ruffled the feathers of many in Minsku because it really was requiring much more nimbleness. And part of what it is in that situation, how we thought to solve it was, the professors are paid by a per credit model, and when you do that, then you're incentivizing that thing, which isn't necessarily bad, except if the students aren't informed, right? And they're all going to go into what they think they should do. And so we, in my bill, made it so the professors were paid regardless in that situation, and it allowed for the customizing to meet the needs of the local community they were working in. And I would hope that when we look at community colleges, at least. I don't think so much with 4 years that we allow or work towards giving higher education more nimbleness there to respond, not immediately, but when it's necessary, so we're not putting people out in that situation. Thank you.
We have two more quick questions, I think, before we're finished. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. In several conversations I've had in the last few weeks with both MNSCU and the U of M, they seem to indicate that they've kind of gone away from the model that I was accustomed to when I was going through my bachelor's and later my master's, and that was to have a one-on-one advisor in my major. And they seem to say that there was a hole, and there isn't that advisor, there isn't that counselor anymore that sits down with a student one-on-one and kind of maps out their future. And I was told, you know, if you get a bachelor's in psychology, you have to get a master's if you want to do anything in the field, really. And so I did, and I got that. And so I'm just wondering, are you also familiar with that? Is that something that these models have gone away from, that they no longer have this one-on-one advisor?
Commissioner Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Neill, I think it's better for me to leave the University of Minnesota and MNSCU to describe what they think they're doing, what they've done there. But what I can tell you is the research is really, really dramatic around the country that for the students who were not getting through, the students that were not getting it done for, that is absolutely one of the key components. Mm-hmm. With regards to how they've designed the university in MNSCU, I think it would be better if I let them talk to you about that, because I don't want to. They're more knowledgeable about it, and I would just have an opinion. They might have more facts.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Our last question, I think, is from Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think representatives have touched on this a bit, but I'm firmly of the belief that, you know, not every kid has to go to a four-year college, and in Bloomington in particular, we are forming what's called the Career Center, and we're working with employers and with Normandale Community College and Hempen Tech to address the jobs that are out there today, high-paid manufacturing jobs in some cases, and I think that's a very good model, and I'm excited to work into it. I wanted to know your thoughts on it.
Commissioner
Book. Mr. Chairman, the two that have been mentioned, Century and Normandale, are doing great stuff. I think generally in Minnesota, when you compare it nationally, we've got really good post-secondary institutions, and so we ought not lose sight of that. But having said that, we got a lot of work to do to be as successful as we need to be. So everything you described, I think I am aware vaguely what Bloomington's doing there. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you've got a lot of 4 years working directly with 2 years now. And so I think almost anything you can think of or have heard about that should be done or tried exists somewhere in the Minnesota systems. And I think our issue should be, how do we facilitate, as I would suggest your issue might be, how do you facilitate best practices being kind of scaled up around the institutions as appropriate? And I'm guessing MNSCU and everybody would say, absolutely help us, because they do have a lot of good things going on, all of these institutions. It's just that it's maybe not where as scaled up as it needs to be to get the job done we need to do.
Representative Rosenthal, you got another
very quickly, Mr. Chair. A big part of this also, and that makes the Bloomington model work, is getting the employers on board and getting them not only to help design the program, but these students are actually bused into these companies and have apprenticeships, and that really, really goes a long way.
Well, I'm not going to mention the other body, but you're hearing some activity by somebody over there on that exact topic.
Commissioner, I want to thank you for being here. It's been a very interesting conversation and presentation.
Thank you.
Also, thanks for your staff that were there to help along. And we'll see you again.
Thank you.
Look forward to that.
Please, I hope your members would feel free to try to tap our resources for information, as we'll try to do the best we can for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, thank you very much. And members, we are adjourned.